Welcome to another episode with the Ethics Reporter. This is a story about lawyers. It's a story about the most powerful law firms in the United States. Firms whose partners earn $5-8 million a year. Firms whose name opens doors at the Supreme Court, at the Department of Justice, at every Fortune 500 boardroom in America. Firms the rest of the profession has, for two generations, treated as the architecture of the American bar. It is a story about what those firms did when one man decided to come after them. Some fought, most did not. In the spring of 2025, the President of the United States signed executive orders aimed at specific named law firms. The orders would have stripped the firm's lawyers of their security clearance, barred them from the federal building, and terminated federal contracts held by the firm's clients. They named the firms directly. They cited grievances directly. The grievances were not about misconduct. They were about cases the firm had taken. Clients they had represented, lawyers they had once hired. Within weeks, nine of the country's largest law firms surrendered. They went to the White House, sat across the Donald Trump, and cut deals. Nine firms pledged nearly $1 billion in free legal service pro bono work to cause of the president's choosing. In exchange, he agreed not to sign orders against them. Four other firms refused. They sued. Every single one of them won. This is the story of how the most powerful private law firms in America allowed themselves to become legal vassals of the executive branch in exchange for permission to keep practicing law. It is about the lawyers who cut the deals and the lawyers who refused. It is about a profession that says it exists to serve the rule of law, and when the rule of law actually came under attack, most chose not to. It's also a story about money, about what each firm risks, about how $1 billion profits per partner figures rearrange themselves overnight into negotiating leverage in the overall office. And it is a story about silence, about a profession with hundreds of ethics rules, bar associations in every state, disciplinary committees and grievance procedures, that when its most powerful members signed promises to do legal work for one political faction in exchange for protection, said almost nothing, did almost nothing, has to this day done almost nothing. I'm your host. This is the Ethics Reporter. This is the story of how big law was bought. On March 6, 2025, Trump signed Executive Order 14230 addressing risks from Perkins Coie LLP. Perkins Coie is a Seattle-founded firm, 16 offices, about 1,200 lawyers. They represented the Democratic National Committee for decades. Their election law group hired the opposition research firm behind what became known as the dossier to Trump that made the firm that helped manufacture the Russian investigation. The order suspended security clearance for every lawyer at the firm. All 1,200 of them, including associates not yet alive, when the firm took on the DND. It directed agencies to terminate federal contracts held by the firm's client, to terminate any federal lease where Perkins had had office space, and to deny its lawyers access to federal buildings. For a modern law firm, that's a death warrant. Strip the clearances, strip the client's contracts, strip building assets. There is no firm left. That's a shell. Perkins Coie sued the next day. 8 days later, Trump signed an identical order against Paul, Weiss, Rifkind, Worthen, and Garrison. 15 offices, 1,500 lawyers. Profit per partner above $7 million a year. Chaired by Brad Karp since 2008. The grievance Paul Weiss had once employed Mark Pomerantz, a prosecutor who investigated Trump before leaving the Manhattan DA's office and had left the firm before the investigation even began. Over the next 4 weeks, similar orders hit Jenner and Block, Widmer Hale, and Sussman Godfrey. Each cited a specific lawyer or representation that had offended the president. Each used the same template: clearance revoked, contract terminated, access denied. These were not arguments, they were ultimatums. Brad Karp turned 60 in March 2025. He chaired for Weiss for 17 years, tripling profits per partner, recruiting staff from the Justice Department and the Solicitor General's office. He had also spent his career presenting himself as a defender of aggressive value, pro bono work, open letters against. authoritarianism, a 2017 promise to represent stranded travelers for free after Trump's first travel ban. When the order hit on March 14th, Trump was on the phone within hours with general counsels at the firm's largest client. By that night, at least four of the top 10 had called with the same message. They sympathized, but their boards and their own counsel were already planning to move to work elsewhere. 6 days later, Trump was in the Oval Office, no order for Weiss lawyer with him. No notes, just Trump, Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, and White House Counsel David Warren. No transcript, no recording. 40 minutes later, Karp had agreed to commit $40 million in pro bono legal service over the rest of Trump's term, directed towards veterans' fairness in the justice system, combating and other causes mutually agreeable to the president and the firm. For Wiles also agreed to end its diversity, equity, and inclusion hiring policy in favor of merit-based recruitment. Trump revoked the order that evening. The next morning, Karp held a brief all-hands meeting. He told partners the order could have destroyed the firm, that clients couldn't wait for litigation, that an immediate deal was the only path that preserved the institution. He took no questions. By week's end, more than 2,000 lawyers had left. The fall 2025 seat classes saw 53 officers declined, a number the firm hadn't seen in any single year before. Students at Yale, Harvard, and Stanford Law signed letters refusing to interview there. Recruiters showed up to empty interview slots. What had Paul White actually agreed to do? The $40 million is a national figure. Hours of lawyers' time at standard billing rate decided to cost the firm and the president agreed. Those costs could include veterans assistance. They could also include defending the executive branch litigation or representing the political allies in personal legal matter. The deal never specifies it and was never written down in any publicly available document. What is written down is a joint statement announcing the firm condemns anti-Semitism and we end DEI policies. Nothing about how the pro bono hours will be used, who decides, or what happens if or why disagree with the president about it. Legally, the deal is unenforceable. No consideration, no standing, no remedy for which. But politically, it enforces itself through the exact mechanism that created it. If Paul Weiss doesn't perform to the president's satisfaction, the executive order comes back. The leverage never goes away. Karp later told the Hill the order could easily have destroyed our firm. He said he had no regret, what he never acknowledged in any forum, what was he actually giving up the independence of the firm. After Paul Weiss, the deal came fast.
Scouting apps, 2,000 lawyers of his partner, above 5 million, hadn't even received an executive order. They negotiated proactively, reading the writing on the wall, and pledged $100 million to avoid coming the next exam. Their mailbag, $100 million, Will Weaver and Gallagher, $100 million, Cadwallader, $100 million, Kirkland and Ellis, the largest firm in the world by revenue, $125 million. Lawton and Watkin, $125 million. Simpson Thatcher, $125 million. A&O Sherman, $125 million. 9 firms, roughly $1 billion, directed to cause of Trump's choosing over the course of his time. Each followed a team script, a private meeting, a chairman negotiating personally, a Truth Society announcement, a press release framing it as partnership for the public good, reassurance to clients that nothing had changed, then silence. Do the math. $1 billion at a generous average living rate of $700 an hour works out to roughly 1.4 million lawyers' hours spread across 9 firms over 3.5 years. That's about 40,000 hours a year per firm. From Kirkland, with 3,500 lawyers, that's around roughly 2% of total annual lawyer time be directed not towards whatever the firm thinks serves the public interest, but towards whatever the executive branch tells it to do, with no mechanism to decline the specific request. What has the administration done with this time? Public reporting has identified scathing lawyers defending the administration in immigration litigation and authorities' amicus briefs against diversity programs in federal hiring. We will prefer advising a presidential commission whose recommendation includes limiting federal court power to issue nationwide injunctions. LATAM, representing an industry group challenging environmental rules from the prior administration. None of this is legal on its face, but the question isn't whether any single representative is permissible. It's whether a firm that has pledged hundreds of millions in service to the president under threat of destruction can be said to exercise independent professional judgment in any meaningful sense. Pekinskoy sued first on March 11. The case went to Judge Beverly Howell, an Obama appointee, former chief judge of the D.C. District Court, who had overseen the Mueller's grand jury proceedings during Trump's first term. She didn't wait an emergency hearing within days, a temporary restraining order, then full briefing. On May 2, 2025, she wrote, her opinion runs over 100 pages, methodologically rejecting every justification the government offered. One line has since been quoted in nearly every related ruling, that using government power to settle a personal vendetta against a disliked business is not a legitimate exercise of presidential authority. The administration appealed, the case seeked the D.C. Circuit, and nearly every appellate lawyer who commented the appeal to fail. Jenna and Block was targeted for once employing Andrew Weissman, a former Mueller prosecutor who'd already left the firm they sued. The case went to Judge John Bates, a Judge Bush appointee with decades of experience on executive branch cases. He ruled for Jenna, calling the order a tool of retribution and citing the First Amendment due process and separation of power. Wilmer Hale, the firm that employed Robert Mueller himself after his service as special counsel, was targeted by name for the exact reason they sued. Judge Richard Leon, another Bush appointee, ruled against the administration, calling the order a blatant attempt to intimidate lawyers from representing his favored client. Susma Guthrie, the smallest of the four at about 150 lawyers, was targeted representing Dominion voting system in its defamation suit against Fox News, the case that produced a $787 million settlement in 2023, the suit Judge Lauren R. Khan, a Biden appointee, ruled for Sussman, noting the firm's only offense was representing a client whose win the president found politically inconvenient. For lawsuits for judges, two appointed by Republicans, two by Democrats, four unanimous rulings against the others, one of the clearest judicial rebukes of executive overreach in modern history. Every competent constitutional lawyer in the country knew, from the moment these orders were signed, that they wouldn't survive review. The settling firms had the same constitutional law partners, the same appellate practice, the same access to the same case law. They knew the orders would fall on the merit. They settled anyway because the calculation wasn't about merit, it was about what would happen to client in the months between orders and its eventual invalidation. It was about which partner would defend, which business would flee. The firms calculated correctly that president would damage them faster than the court would protect them. The four fighting firms made the opposite calculation. They took the financial hit, Pekinskoy's revenue dropped, and estimated $60 to $90 million in 2025. Wilmer Hale lost corporate account. Jenna saw associate attrition it hadn't seen in a generation. Sussman's smallest of the four paid the highest percentage cost. They went anyway, they won. Before the ethics rule, consider a different set of lawyers facing the same choice in the same month and making the opposite call. On February 19, 2025, Daniel Sassoon, 38 years old, a former senior clerk, a federally society conservative, the acting United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York, walked into the acting attorney general's office and resigned. She had been ordered by the acting deputy attorney general, Emil Bov, to dismiss the corruption indictment of New York Mayor Eric Adams by bribery, wire fraud, conspiracy, returned by a grand jury in September 2024. The order didn't claim his black merit. He said the prosecution interfered with Adams' ability to help the administration on immigration enforcement. Sassoon's 8-page resignation letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi described the conversations in which Adams' lawyer had explicitly offered immigration cooperation in exchange for dismissal, a quick quo she called contrary to her duties as federal prosecutor. Hagan Scotton, the lead prosecutor on the case, took combat tours in Iraq as special forces, declared for Chief Justice Roberts, also a conservative, resigned the same day. His letter contained one sentence and had become a touchstone that the government would eventually find someone foolish or cowardly enough to file the dismissal motion, but it was never going to be him. Within 48 hours, five more prosecutors resigned from the Justice Department Public Interview Section. Rather than take over the case, the department eventually found someone to file the motion. The case was dismissed, Adams said, Mayor. Now, ask the question the profession hadn't asked enough. If a 38-year-old prosecutor with a young family and a bright future was willing to resign rather than file a motion she believed was unethical, what does it say about the chairman of a white Skadden, Melbourne, Latham, Kirkland, Simpson, Thatcher, Cadwalder, Wilkie, and A and O Sherman, that none of them could be moved to comparable conduct? Brad Tapp was 60, was over $100 million, with a career spent describing himself as a defender of the rule of law when he first came, he flew to Washington and got a deal. Sasson walked out of her job she spent a decade earning with no severance because she knew what kind of lawyer she wanted to be. There's no model rule that captures this difference, but every lawyer who watched Every and March 2024 knows it. The profession's ethical capacity, when actually tested, turned out to vary with where they check him from. What the settling firms did is not, on its face, a violation on any specific rule. That's part of the problem. The model rules of professional conduct governs individual lawyers. Conflicts, confidentiality, lines on, they are almost entirely silent on what happens when a firm as an institution enters a relationship that compromises its independence as an institution. They were written for an era of independent partnership, not 1500 lawyers, multinational business with management committees and brand strategies. A few will brush against the issue. Rule 5.4 says a lawyer can let someone who employs or pays them directly or regulate their professional judgment. It was written with insurance companies in mind, not the president, but the principle applies. When cracks committed or wise hours to cause acceptable to Trump, with no specification of which causes or kinds, that is direction, that is regulation, that is exactly what the rule prohibits. Rule 1.7 on conflicts of interest. The settling firms now owe a continuing obligation to the president that sits in structural tension, with obligations to clients whose interests may conflict with his. A firm representing a client before a federal agency is potentially conflicted by its own pro bono debt to the executive branch that provides the agency. The firm says they manage this with internal walls and that no client has complained, but the size of client is in evidence of it doesn't exist. It's evidence clients under the same dynamic that produced the deal in the first place. Complaining would mean siding against president's interest and no client wants to send that signal. Rule 8.4d, the catch-all. A lawyer can't engage in conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice. A firm trading legal service for relief from executive sanction is, if the words mean anything, exactly that. The administration of justice depends on the bar's independence. A bar that can be bought is not a bar, it is a contractor. These aren't radical readings. They are the readings any first-year law student would reach on the final exam. What has the organized bar done with them? The American Bar Association issued a statement in April 2025 expressing concerns, no names, no disciplinary referrals, no rule change. The New York State Bar Association, which covers 7 of the 9 settling firms, had a CLE panel. No grievance filed. California's are covering Latham and Kirkland issued a generic statement on lawyer independence. Texas covering Sussman took no action at all. In Texas, more than 400 lawyers signed a public letter calling for an investigation. The bar acknowledged received no investigation open. Similar letters in New York got similar responses. The bar didn't conclude the conduct was acceptable. It declined to reach any conclusion at all. Studying panel holdings, committee referring, and then nothing. Some of these committees, in fact, included partners from the settling firm. Money is the easy measure, and on money, the settling firms did fine. Profits per partner held, most clients stayed. Some new clients arrived, drawn to the firm's demonstrative flexibility from a 2025 partnership distribution standpoint. The deals were successful risk management. Within a year, the fighting firms had recovered most of their lost businesses. Some clients returned once the ruling vacated their position. And in some markets, the fighting firms became the firms to hire if they wanted a lawyer who couldn't be intimidated. The resources is in what money doesn't measure. Talent, the most ambitious, most convicted young lawyers in the country are no longer interviewing at the settling firms. They are going to the fighting firms, to boutique, to clerkship, and then expensive firms, or leaving the profession entirely. That decline won't be visible in 2026. It will be visible in 2030, when the next generation of partners should be forming and isn't. Clients suffocated general counsel noticed that their law firms had handed federal executive leverage over the firm itself. A client in a regulatory dispute or a litigation against the federal government now has visiting twice before hiring or setting firm for that specific work. The shift will be incremental, not dramatic. It will look like normal market drift, but it will run one direction. Federal judges read the news. A partner from a settling firm walked into a courtroom as he navigates a lawyer whose firm has a relationship with the executive branch that gives the executive leverage over it. Opposing counsel knows it. The client knows it. The judge knows it. Nobody can say how that affects credibility in the room, but it does. The profession itself of roughly 1.3 million licensed lawyers in America, almost none work about Weiss or Skadden or Kirkland. Most are solo practitioners, small firm lawyers, government attorneys handling divorce and wills, and small businesses with modest pay. When the most powerful firms in their profession call deals like this, the message to everyone else is that the rule of law is something you pay for when you can afford it and abandon when you can't. We covered in an earlier episode an office where private lawyers use federal property to do private political work. This is the opposite story, private lawyers being used by the president as if they were federal property. They are the same story. The line between government, business, and presidential personal political interest is being erased. In federal buildings occupied by private lawyers and private firms directed by public power, in prosecutors fired for refusing to political connected cases, the erasure is public. Everything else is a concern. In 2025, the premier of an independent bar was tested. 9 of the most powerful firms in the country failed. 4 passed. The bar association meant to enforce that premises mostly stood aside. We are recording this in spring 2026. The deals are still in place. The pro bono hours are still being delivered. Everyone is still pretending the profession hasn't changed. It has. The lawyers who took the deals will tell you they had no choice. That the orders left them no option, that their duty was to their clients and not employees, that the alternative was destruction. The lawyers who refused will tell you the alternative was litigation, a hard year, and a fight they were going to win on the merit. You don't need to be a lawyer to decide which account, right? You only need to read 4 federal court opinions. They are unanimous. They say the orders were illegal, retaliatory, and could not survive constitutional review. They say the law firms that thought were right, which means the firms that settled were wrong, not unwise, wrong. They surrendered something they didn't have to surrender, for protection they didn't need, and handed the president a point of leverage over the legal profession that future presidents of either party will find waiting for them. The Bar Association would hold them accountable. The Grievance Committee won't. The law school won't. The client for now won't. This podcast will. I'm your host, this is the Ethics Reporter. If you want to support independent legal ethics journalism, donate at theethicsreporter.com. If you have a tip about misconduct or any charge of them or association, send it to the secret tip line on the site. We read everything. See you again in another episode, and thanks for listening.